I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast, brought to you by the Society of Addiction Psychology. Today, we have Desiree Moskal joining us. Des is a doctoral candidate in clinical psychology at Syracuse University and a pre-doctoral intern at the VA Maryland Healthcare System University of Maryland School of Medicine Internship Consortium. And she'll be talking about her research that focuses on the intersection between chronic pain and substance use disorder.
All right, Des, welcome to the show. How's it going?
Good. I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you on. Can you tell us a little bit about your training?
Sure, I'd love to. And I've heard a few others on the podcast sort of share their non-traditional backgrounds, and I think it would be helpful if I did the same, primarily so that listeners don't think there's just one right path or one path to kind of get you to a certain goal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Well, with that, I did start my undergraduate training at Damon College. That's a small private school in Buffalo. I had wanted actually to initially work in healthcare, started as a physician assistant major. But after a few chem and bio classes and watching a knee surgery, I knew that medicine in that way was not my calling.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, not for me. But I did learn about psychology, and I was particularly interested in the flexibility of that degree. I'm someone who likes to be involved in many different activities, and I have a difficult time sort of selecting just one option. So you're familiar probably with You Pick Two at Panera. That was made for people like me. Yeah, really hard time choosing just one thing. Anyways, I wanted to go for psychology then. And I mentioned Damon is a really small private school. There's no graduate psychology program, very little to no research taking place. So when I graduated, I hadn't been sure exactly what I wanted to do. I'd considered, graduate training for clinical psych, but I knew that was a huge commitment. So before, signing up for that, and I didn't even know actually if I would have been qualified, as an applicant without any research training. I took a couple of years off then and worked as a research assistant before applying to graduate school. And during that time, I was at the Buffalo VA, the Veterans Affairs Hospital, specifically the Center for Integrated Healthcare. And I worked there for a couple years as a research assistant, and it was really eye-opening. So I worked on an RCT, a randomized clinical trial, of a web-based program for PTSD and substance use disorder. And for those that might not be familiar, PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder, sort of a disorder related to trauma. And so I was doing some clinical interviews for that research study, and it was frankly heart-wrenching hearing how substance use and trauma had really impacted people's lives. And through that experience, I was thinking, this could be another way that I can help people. I know that's, cliche, but wanted to do something along those lines. And so I then pursued substance use research training. And in terms of that, I had applied to, several schools, but Syracuse University being the one that seemed like the best fit. And Steve Maisto, Dr. Steve Maisto, was open to having me. So I was really excited about that and worked with him for several years, actually still working with him because I am in my last year as a clinical psychology doctoral student. But with Steve as my mentor, I had the opportunity to engage in a ton of different research projects. Both of you know Steve and know that he is very involved. Has lots of different colleagues and collaborators too. So I was able to do lots of different things. And really there are like three primary areas that I got involved in, or they can be categorized as three. The first is research that aims to better understand the interrelation between substance use and related factors, and in particular, physical pain. And the goal there being to minimize the associated problems and improve functioning for folks who are suffering. The second area is to better understand the clinical course and recovery of substance use disorder and identify mechanisms of treatment change. The third area was related to program evaluation and specifically outcome evaluation of addiction treatment programs. So that was a lot of fun, something that in clinical psychology, I don't think we usually get a whole lot of experience with. Those were private companies. So I was really excited to have a part in that. And so, you know, those are the three categories I've been most involved in, but the one that I'll talk about most today is the first. So specifically focusing on pain and alcohol as it relates to my independent research.
Thanks, Des. We really appreciate hearing all about, and you know, I've done some interviews, clinical interviews for PTSD, and man, it is awful. Some of the things these people have experienced. So I feel you there.
Agreed.
Yeah. And I know I worked as a research assistant during graduate school on a substance use and PTSD co-occurring study. And, you know, it's really, I think, a testament to these people's resilience, how much they've been able to kind of withstand and keep going and things like that. And so I sincerely appreciate individuals who focus their work on trying to help these people get unstuck and kind of live the lives that they want to live. So thank you for that. And then now you're currently on internship, right?
I am, yes. So I'm at the Baltimore VA right now. It's a consortium, so they're linked with the University of Maryland as well, but all of my rotations are at the Baltimore VA. And this is the last stage of my training as a clinical psychology PhD student. So for those that might not be familiar, and if you're going for clinical psych, that last year of training is a primarily clinical training year. And then you are able to get your PhD once you finish all of those requirements. So that's where I'm at now. And fortunately, they have an enhanced research minor. So I've been able to continue my research even on clinical internship, and I'm working with folks that are linked up with the MIRAC. That's Mental Illness Research Education Clinical Center, I think, through the VA. So they focus on research, and also another researcher at the University of Maryland, the School of Medicine, Melanie Bennett and Dan Roach. So really excited to be working with them too.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's a great training place. Some of my closest friends have actually trained there with Melanie and Dan. So it's great to see there's a nice connection to that. All right. So why don't we talk a little bit about some of your research? So I know that you talked a little bit about how some of your work focuses on this intersection between pain and substance use, or physical pain and substance use disorder. And we think this is a really interesting topic to really get into some of the weeds on today, because it's kind of gained a lot of media attention over the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And so we're hoping maybe you could kind of jump in and start telling us a little bit broadly about where the literature is at and some of the background on this issue.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm really excited to talk about this. And you're completely right that it has sort of exploded as a topic in the general media. But then even in terms of research, there's a lot more coming out now. So you said, you know, tell me about where the literature is at right now. And I can say, well, it's developing. But for instance, NIAAA, I think within the past 5 years, put out a program announcement specifically requesting research on pain and substance use. That might've been specific to alcohol, and then looking at mechanisms of that interrelation. So it's something that people are, you know, realizing is really important and wanting to know more about. In terms of sort of diving into my research and talking about that, I think it might be helpful if I actually take the long way around this answer too, and give a little bit of background in terms of how I came to this particular research. I know as a graduate student, I'd always been a little bit, or at least starting out, been a little bit unsure about, you know, well, how do you develop a research idea? And how do you know it's good enough? Or how do you know that you know, it hasn't been done before, things like that. So when I started out in the field, I had just assumed that, you know, certain things were more clear cut or established than they really are. So for instance, if, you know, I went up to a random person on the street and asked them if pain caused alcohol use, you know, do people in pain drink because of their pain? 99% of people, I think, I haven't done this study, but I think a lot of people would say, yes, of course it does. It seems like an obvious fact that people in pain drink. And of course, that alcohol in the long term is not going to be good for your health. And you know, those are problems that have been around for like all of human civilization, both pain and substance use, and in this case, alcohol. But in fact, although it feels like it's a well understood, you know, fact that individuals in pain use alcohol to cope with their pain, it's not actually as established as one might think, or as I thought. So that's where I was getting at, as you know, as I dove into the literature and looked more at it, it wasn't actually clear that pain causes alcohol. So there'd been no empirical evidence to suggest that that's true. There'd never been an experimental study testing that relationship before in any population. And doing that type of work or knowing that answer empirically is important because it helps you understand the different mechanisms that might underlie that relationship. And then also to know that it's empirically true as opposed to just, you know, a thought that we have. Certainly there have been other things in our life that, you know, we thought were true, and then more research comes out and we learn it's not. So I'll pause there and just check in, like, you know, in terms of kind of coming down to an idea, is that something that you all have like experienced, you know, things that you thought were true or thought were in the literature and then realized that weren't?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the science, you know. It's like where we have these ways of seeing the world, and we often see existence and you know, sort of narratively. So we make these connections between an X and a Y, and sometimes that's not there. So I'm curious though, because I mean, like you were saying, that would have been my assumption as well. I would have assumed that. Maybe it doesn't cause alcohol use, but it at least would be associated with, you know, increased risk. So I'm guessing that this is what you explored.
Yes. So what you're getting at there is the association, and that is established. So there have been a lot of cross-sectional, and longitudinal studies that do look at the association between pain and substance use, and then alcohol use specifically. My primary work has been in the realm of alcohol use, although I've dabbled a little bit in terms of research in cannabinoids, and I'm certainly familiar with research on other substance use as well, such as opioids. But in terms of the association, certainly that is there. But what's been missing is that causal link. So when you're talking about causal links in research, really what's needed is experimental research. And so as I was sort of considering this topic, seeing this association, Sam, that you just pointed out that, you know, it certainly is there, I wanted to know if we looked at an experimental study on this, does physical pain cause alcohol use? And I'll sort of take a step back from that too and say, you know, when I'm talking about pain, people have maybe different ideas about what that looks like. And I appreciated earlier too that Noah, when you were sort of introducing the topic, you said pain and then you said, well, physical pain. And that's something that's important to sort of differentiate as well. There's actually been a recent definition that came out from the International Association for the Study of Pain that they recently revised the definition of pain. And it's the way that they define it is as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with or resembling that associated with actual or potential tissue damage. Now, that's a lot of words that if not written in front of you might be hard to follow. But the key takeaway there is that the definition of pain is complex, multifaceted, and it has an emotional component.
Yeah, I'm really curious, and you may not know or have an example, but if you do, I would love to hear it, of what an emotional sort of component would be like related to tissue damage.
Absolutely. So when experiencing pain, so if you have that tissue damage, often folks are going to experience some sort of negative affect, right? So either anxiety, increased anxiety. There's actually a construct, pain-related anxiety, pain catastrophizing, the idea that when you are in a situation that causes you pain, that it's even more enhanced in terms of that negative affect, that anxiety, that unpleasantness that comes. Yep. So that's that's what would be sort of related to the emotional component.
Interesting. So that's now sort of considered a part of the definition, would be all of these emotional, even maybe even almost cognitive elements of negative affect that sort of accompanies pain.
Yes, 100%. Because in the past, like very traditionally, the way that pain was considered is that it's something that happens to the body, right? Like some sort of damage, tissue damage, and that it was really just signals sent up to the brain that said, you know, ow, you're in pain. This hurts. Stop doing whatever you're doing. But what we've learned is that even in the absence of that current tissue damage, right? So for instance, an individual that had pain or some sort of surgery, and then after the normal healing time, their body itself is healed, but they still have pain. So there's not currently then any tissue damage, but they can still experience pain. And that's more related to that emotional component, where they, you know, they're experiencing heightened negative affect, perhaps because they're experiencing this pain.
That's really interesting. And I've never known or thought of that, I guess, as to be a part of pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. And like I say, they just recently updated the definition to be more inclusive,
right,
I guess, or comprehensive, because we are learning much more about pain, learning that two people, for instance, can have the same exact external pain stimuli, but have different experiences with that, right? And there are different reasons for that, different personal characteristics, I'm sure you can imagine. And even what I was mentioning earlier in terms of pain-related anxiety or pain catastrophizing, those are individual characteristics that vary from person to person. So, you know, one's experience is going to be different depending on what level of those you have and other related characteristics.
Yeah, I think it's super interesting. And it makes a lot of sense to me when I hear it, right? Like it's not something that maybe I would have kind of offered up on my own, but when I hear it said out loud, it makes a total sense to me, right? So if you think about like the kind of origin story of pain and like what its role is, right? Like it's an important signal that corrective action is required. Uh-huh. Is essentially one of the like the key origin stories around pain, right? And emotional pain, right? So negative affect, right? Anger, anxiety, sadness, all these things are supposed to prompt corrective action also, right? Mm-hmm. And there's also like a learning part of that goes into it, right? Like our brain codes memories based on emotional and pain-related sensory experiences. And that's kind of how we organize it, right? Like if for anybody out there who's seen the movie Inside Out, right? Like that's kind of what they're talking about when they're talking about how the memories are coded, right?
Yeah, that's neuroscience. It's imaging,
it's based on,
right? So it's, you know, there's a little creature inside your head that, you know,
obviously, yeah, it's a
memories.
Sadness. I think it's Phyllis from The Office. Actually.
It's Phyllis from The Office. That's right.
Yeah, that does that, right? But that would make sense, right? So like I touched my hand on the hot stove and then I have like a physical pain sensation, but I also have an emotional characteristic there. Like I'm angry with myself that I did that. All of that is supposed to facilitate learning, right? And it's kind of like woven into the fabric of that experience to make it maximum like future benefit for behavior change, right? But it also creates an infrastructure for this to have lasting kind of unintended negative consequences on this. I think your point at the beginning of this is really important, right? Which is like, which one of these things kind of comes first, right? Like, is it that I have pain that I use to cope with it, for instance, or is it that I have, you know, substance use and that helps me facilitate pain due to numbness in my body, and then I end up experiencing physical injury, right? Or I have traumatic experiences, right? Or these types of things. And so I think that you're to understand the definition of it is for us to kind of break apart these individual constituent areas and understand it empirically. And so I was wondering if you could kind of take us into some of that stuff that you've done experimentally and help us kind of understand what's going on here.
Absolutely. And I guess before I do that, though, I do want to hone in on something that you said there, which is, you know, the directionality. And so a lot of my work has been looking at the direction specifically from pain to alcohol. But there's a lot of research, well, not a lot. There's more research that's been coming out recently that theorizes and proposes different models for that relationship. And For instance, Zalen colleagues and Dietrian colleagues are some folks who in the field have really been putting out different models related to pain and substance use. And what we believe is that pain and alcohol and other substance use are interrelated bidirectionally, such that when you're in pain, it might lead you to use substances. And when you use substances, especially over a longer period of time, it then can lead to increased pain, whether that's through injury related to intoxication, for instance, or due to neuro and physiological changes that happen from substance use that might make you more prone to pain. Mm. So I just wanted to highlight that.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you're spot on.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I know Ryan Carpenter, who's now at University of Missouri, St. Louis,
correct.
I think, has done a little bit of EMA work, ecological momentary assessment work, outlining this in emotionally, right? But I think he has also been looking at it within the realm of physical pain, and he finds sort of similar results, this negative reinforcement feedback loop.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. He sure does. You're exactly right. And in fact, I'm going to put in a shameless plug here. So Ryan Carpenter, myself, Katie Wickowitz, and Jeff Boys and I are all going to be giving a talk at CPA on pain and substance use, and specifically
the
emerging research there. Yeah. So really excited about that. Come check us out. And my advisor, Steve Maestro, is going to be discussing for the talk. So really excited about that.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, anyone listening, that's Collaborative Perspectives on Addiction. It's March 17th through the 19th. All online. So, you know, that's going to be coming up next month, and there's a lot of great posters. There's a lot of great research. I couldn't tell you how much it costs right now to register. I don't remember. But I think it's relatively cheap. So consider signing up and attending and hearing about all the great research.
Yeah. And shameless plug for us, we're going to have a special episode dedicated to posters, award-winning posters at CPA this year. So that'll be coming up in a few months, right around the time of the conference, is that we'll have a special episode, lightning round episode of posters, presentations for the award-winning CPA posters 20, from CPA.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah.
Sorry, Des, we went off in a different direction, but let's get into your research. I'm really curious. You have me on the edge of my seat here about the directionality.
<it's>... Yeah. I've been holding up. So absolutely. So I mentioned, my research is looking at pain to alcohol, and the theory sort of underlying that is related to the negative reinforcement models of substance use, which say that, that if you're in a state, an aversive state, whether that's physical or emotional, and in the case of pain, remember they have an emotional and a physical component. Mm-hmm. But if you are in an aversive state, then that increases your negative affect. And that increased negative affect is going to then result in increased urge to drink, urge to use substances, and or actual substance use. And so with that as a theoretical basis of my work, I set out and designed a study with some amazing colleagues. Martin DeVito was one of them. And then, of course, my advisor, and looked at this empirically and in an experimental study. So half of the folks were randomized to a pain condition, the other folks, a no pain condition. And I'll tell you a little bit more about what that looks like in a minute. And then looked at their increased negative affect, so that we can really test this mechanistic model, and then their urge to drink alcohol. So in this study, I did not measure actual alcohol consumption. So that's something I always like to put an asterisk on. It's not actual alcohol consumption, but it's urge, which we know is associated with alcohol use. With actual alcohol use outside of the lab. And in this study, we enrolled individuals who were hazardous drinkers. They were a college student, hazardous drinkers. And perhaps not surprising, what we found is that those in the pain group did in fact experience increased negative affect and increased urge to use alcohol. So the hypothesis that we thought would be true based on all of the literature was in fact the case here. And I mentioned I'd say a little bit more about what pain looks like in this. So we do know that experimental pain, just like alcohol urge, is a valid indicator of pain outside of the lab. So we experimentally induced pain using a thermode, which is a computer-controlled device, and we place that on individuals' forearm, like a 3x3 thermode. And in addition to that, which emits heat, we also applied capsaicin, which is a chili pepper derivative. And when applied to the skin, it stings, it hurts, it burns, it's awful. And we put both of those together. So people were definitely in a good amount of pain. That was probably my least favorite part of graduate school, is putting these people in pain, at least for the most part. Some of the folks that came in that were, you know, like really excited about the pain paradigm, I kind of felt excited to see, you know, their reaction. So those ones I didn't feel as bad, but that's what we did for the pain group. And then to allow it to be, you know, a controlled experiment, the no pain group had everything the same, except instead of heat that was painful, it was just room temperature. And instead of the capsaicin, they got water.
Yeah, I don't know how you, well, it's not that painful. It sounds like it's not like, you know, torture. But I don't know if our IRB at the University of Memphis would have approved that. So you found that experimentally induced pain did increase the urge to drink, right?
Yeah.
So what do you think that means for your model?
Yeah. Well, it certainly supports the one direction of this bi-directional theorized model, in that it seems if and when folks are in pain, they do then experience this increased negative affect or like total unpleasantness that then increases their urge to drink. So in terms of a causal effect, we did find support for that. Now, of course, we're not testing the other relationship, which might be the case, but in terms of this population and how the study was, we can't test that other link. You know, we would have to do that with actual alcohol use, which actually my advisor and a couple of colleagues are doing a study like that, results pending. So, you know, I won't share too much about it, but I know that there are mechanistic studies that are ongoing to determine if, you know, when you are in pain, how that, or I'm sorry, when you are using alcohol, how that affects your pain, because pain is an analgesic. And so, you know, the idea being that perhaps it will decrease your pain, or really just wondering, you know, more about what that relationship looks like.
Yeah, I think that's a really important aspect, right? And also, I think it's important to understand kind of the two parts of pain here, right? So the emotional component and the physical sensory component to it too, in part because some of the work, I've actually got two studies that have looked at this other path, using EMA work, which is where we look at like fine-grained observations in the natural environment with cell phone applications. And we find some interesting things. This is one of those ones where like it doesn't play out always the way that we think it does. At least for alcohol, we found that alcohol reduced negative affect, but only for individuals that identified as women.
Interesting.
And that individuals who identified as men kind of returned to baseline on a natural course, regardless if they drank or not. And then we found, I have another study where we do it with cannabis in youth. And there we found that cannabis use only reduced negative affect if an individual had a lot of cannabis use disorder symptoms. So 6 or more symptoms, which is considered severe cannabis use disorder.
That sounds like almost withdrawal.
In part, it could be. But even just some of the other affectual parts of it, but all of them experienced increases in positive emotion for the cannabis use disorder study I'm talking about, regardless of their use disorder symptoms and things like that. And so there was this increase in positive emotion that occurred and only a decrease in negative emotions that happened for individuals that were high in substance use disorder symptoms specifically. And so I'm really curious about how this, but that's clearly an observational study that misses like an entire important channel in the signal of physical pain. And I would expect physical pain to have a lot more consistent relationship just due to the way that the pharmacology of substances works on the sensory system. But hey, I thought it would be super obvious with emotions too. And that was not the case.
Yeah, well, your study, like, you know, I think like good research tends to create more questions than answers. And it does, you know, create a lot of questions in my mind. And some of them have to do with the populations, right? And some of them have to do with other aspects of the actual pain induction experiment. So I'm thinking that, you know, you selected for drinkers, and I'm curious about if you selected for, you know, people with chronic pain, that how the effects might be different. I also am thinking of this old study that Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky did, where they put your hand in an ice bucket and, you know, experimentally assigned people to have it in for a certain amount of time, or have it in for longer, but have the temperature rise over, you know, the last like 30 seconds. And people tended to, if they had to choose again, pick the longer one, which is, you know, technically you're feeling a lot more pain. You know, maybe it's slightly warmer towards the end, but it's still very cold. And I'm just wondering about how all of these types of things sort of start to have an impact when it starts to relate to substance use.
Yeah, you bring up several good points, and a couple of those questions are things too that I've considered, and actually that, you know, drove other studies that I'm getting involved in or planning to get involved in. It really is like fascinating to consider all these different factors. You mentioned, for instance, the clinical pain samples or individuals, right? So I didn't study that because I was trying to reduce the confounds associated with this. So in an experimental study, especially in a field like this, where it's early on in terms of its development, I wanted to reduce the number of confounds. So selecting young adult drinkers as opposed to drinkers that have been drinking for a long time, where they might have different, where their bodies might have changed actually because of the substance use. And then similarly with chronic pain or clinical pain that's ongoing, those folks are often, just like what Noah was saying, have learned different things about the experience of pain. And so that adaptation in terms of their learning and in their responses might have an impact on the study results. And then related is, we know that pain is often associated with different mental health problems like depression, for instance. And so, you know, it just adds additional confounds in terms of that experiment. But those are all important things to consider and definitely need to be studied. And in fact, so when I go to postdoc next year, which I'm going to the Center for Integrated Healthcare in Buffalo, I'm going to be working with Gregory Beeler. He has a trial that he just got funded that's looking at chronic pain, and specifically a cognitive behavioral therapy that's brief, delivered in primary care or chronic pain. And I'm looking forward to working with him and, you know, extending that study to then incorporate substance use. So hopefully, Sam, you know, if you have me back in over a year, hopefully I'll have more to say on that.
Yeah. We'd love to have you back. And I think that your study creates sort of the foundation for a lot more studies of this nature to help us understand a problem that we don't understand very well. And, you know, I also know that many medical professionals don't understand pain very well, and in particular, the relationship between pain and substance use. And I heard the statistic maybe 3 years ago, and it could be outdated now, but out of the 120 some medical schools in our country, only 5 had dedicated like classes and sort of certificates related to pain. And yet that is by far the dominant complaint of almost everyone going through our medical system. And it's been the dominant discussion about, you know, in terms of prescription of opioids, and then, you know, the mess that our society caused over the last 2 decades, trying to clean that up and regulating it and stuff. And you bring up a really interesting point that we as psychologists, I think, have a really important place in actually contributing to pain management on a better level, and then in particular sort of interfering with this relationship between pain and substance use.
Absolutely. Because, you know, more traditionally, the way that pain has been treated is from a more pharmacological standpoint, or even, I guess, with things like PT as well, so physical therapy.
Right.
But psychologists and mental health workers do have an important part in treating pain. And it is a tough discussion to have with individuals in pain, because often their initial reaction is, so you think that this is all in my head, right? Which is not the case. And though we know that pain does have this emotional component, and there are behavioral things that we can do to help people in pain. So certainly there are, avenues for us, and there is ongoing research, specifically cognitive behavioral therapy and acceptance and commitment therapy, based treatments, and even combined, that are trying to address this issue of pain. And some of them incorporate substance use as well. So it is an important area that is, currently developing. But you bring up great points there about, how little we know and how much there is still to do. And then also how psychologists can play a role in that and in getting answers.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, right? Like, actually, I think it was just maybe a few weeks ago that the World Health Organization recognized acceptance and commitment therapy as like a frontline treatment for chronic pain, for instance. Mm-hmm. Right. And so mm-hmm. I think people think of pain as like, we need to go to a physician. Mm-hmm. It might be true. And there's also, I think, a lot more about the experience of pain that professionals like psychologists will be able to play a role in here. And so I'm really glad to hear mm-hmm. that you're going to be able to kind of get in at the ground level on some of this work. And correct me if I'm wrong, but did I also hear that you were like circling back to the place that you started?
You did.
Good catch, Noah.
So it came full circle.
Yeah.
It did. When you work with great people, it's nice to keep working with them, and they happen to be doing work that I'd love to do. So it worked out nicely.
Fantastic. Yeah. It's always great to hear when people are able to make like a really cool journey like you've talked about here. And for a second, I'd like to talk a little bit about, so over a couple of episodes now, we've had people on talking about cannabis and cannabis mm-hmm. legislation and things like this. And I know you've done some work in the area of cannabinoids and experimental pain. And I was wondering if you could mm-hmm. speak to us a little bit about some of the work that you've done in this space to kind of help our listeners understand a little bit about what's going on in that space.
Absolutely. I'm glad you bring this up, because you and Sam too were just saying how, we think we know certain things in the literature. And then when we actually do the study, we learn that it's actually not what we thought. So for instance, right now, in many states, people are able to use cannabis to treat their pain. That's how it's prescribed, at least, medical cannabis. And what we actually found. So I did a meta-analysis with one of my colleagues, Martin DeVita, and our advisors. Martin spearheaded this, so I give him full credit here, but I will speak about it. So he led this effort to do a meta-analysis on the effects of cannabinoid administration in the lab and how that impacts experimental pain. So when the idea being that folks think that when you have cannabis, or in this case, it was broader than that, cannabinoids, that it actually impacts your perception of pain. So decreased pain intensity, for instance, decreased pain unpleasantness, et cetera. Well, what we found when we compiled all of these different studies of healthy individuals who underwent an experimental study like this, that actually cannabis and cannabinoids did not influence pain intensity at all. What it did do, however, is it decreased their pain unpleasantness. So they felt a little bit less bad emotionally related to their pain, but it actually did not decrease pain intensity, which I just find fascinating because, they're, in terms of policymakers and whatnot, it's a common belief that pain intensity decreases when you use cannabis. And that's not what we found in this study. It decreases perhaps just the pain unpleasantness associated.
Yeah, I'm really glad to have. Is that out?
It's actually it's in JAMA. What was that? A couple years ago.
Man,
whoa,
JAMA.
Yeah,
Martin, big
talent
has high impact.
So, Martin went big on this.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
He did a really nice job.
Well, that's all. I mean, because we talked about this with Alan last week, you know, mm-hmm. it came up that not last week. I don't know. It was a while ago now. But with Alan Budney, about how the medical marijuana movement in a lot of ways has been sort of a foot in the door, you know, for the marijuana legalization movement. And mm-hmm. I think that there are a lot of good reasons to legalize marijuana, you know, societally, mm-hmm. you know, because of, you know, underrepresented populations and the effect that it specifically has on those groups, the mm-hmm. history, the war on drugs. But it appears that a lot of the medical reasons are just not sort of coming together like we would expect. And you know, I think as scientists, we have to follow the data and we can't use that as a reason to legalize something like marijuana if it is in fact it's not working. Okay. I think that's part of our job as scientists, and you know, we have to hold the trust of our societies.
The literature is definitely sort of trickling behind policy change, which is just fascinating, because you would think that policy would be driven based on the research, but it doesn't necessarily seem to be the case here. I will say though that it's not so awful if cannabis decreases pain and unpleasantness. Like that's great, actually. Right. You know, if people could use it and feel a little bit better, awesome. It's sort of misinformed if we think it's going to decrease pain intensity. Not to mention that, you know, it's a short-term fix where, you know, in the long term, perhaps learning skills now would be more beneficial. So some of those behavioral skills we were talking about earlier related to cognitive behavioral therapy or acceptance and commitment therapy.
Yeah.
And actually that sort of leads into my dissertation, which I expanded on. I didn't even mention actually that study I talked about was my thesis, but I expanded on it for my dissertation, looking at how distraction versus acceptance coping for pain might sort of differentially, how that relationship might change based on what coping strategy folks were using. So we taught them to use a distraction strategy, and the other half of folks we taught to use an acceptance strategy. And then looked at, you know, how does pain influence alcohol urge then? Now, the results of that are still pending, but certainly more will be, more will be able to be shared at the CPA talk. So I'll have more information there.
Cliffhanger.
I know.
Man, you, yeah. This CPA talk, it's going to be amazing.
Des is a proud member of the
I am.
Psychology.
I really am.
And that's really showing up for us right. today here, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
well,
I think you bring up a couple of really interesting points here, and so does Sam. I think here that like one, I think that if we're building an entire legalization movement around medical cannabis, and a lot of that has to do with chronic pain and treatment of other illnesses, I think that's probably just not borne out by the data. I do think that decriminalization of cannabis, specifically to reduce the over policing of communities of color, is warranted, long mm-hmm. overdue, and still important. I think we just need to be able to make sure that we're packaging this in the right way, because as Alan talked a little bit about, right, like the message here is really important, and that we need to be able to make sure that the messages like the work that you're doing here come across as we make these types of societal shifts, which are a lot, many of them are overdue. And I think mm-hmm. Disrupting the difference right here between disrupting like pain, like discomfort, if you will, right, like versus like pain intensity or pain interference, which is another part of pain, is how much it gets in the way of your life. It's not like a small thing. It's just, that's the difference between like maybe experiencing acute pain, like I just poked my finger, versus chronic pain, which is right. like an experience that I have every day. It's this like dull pain that perhaps persists mm-hmm. for long periods of time, at which those different medications, cannabis or otherwise, might have different effects in there, right? And that's like still remains to be seen in an important area of study that I'm hopeful that people like yourself and individuals like Ryan Carpenter, shout out Ryan, who I did postdoc and internship with, working with Bob Miranda, and you know, other people like Joe Dietrich and so forth are kind of on the cutting edge for. And so you really got us on the cliffhanger here And so I'm hopeful that anybody who's listening shows up to CPA to hear a little bit about what's going on, because I am very curious.
Well, and like the consequences of these, like of like making claims. So, you know, opioids, they do make you feel better in the short term. They, mm-hmm. they diminish some pain. Right. But the evidence does not suggest that they can do anything for chronic pain, and in fact might make it worse. And what we've done is, at the same time of introducing this, you know, I won't say we've done it because we were not a part of it, but what, you know, big pharma companies have done is they've introduced this short fix, to solve something that, you know, that feels really bad in the moment, but that is not capable of providing the long-term fix. And we've created a much larger problem, creating the opioid epidemic. And I'm not saying at all that cannabis is anything like, you know, opioids in terms of the addictive potential or the harm, the societal harm that it causes. But the messaging that we use, you know, we have to follow data. And to say that something like endocannabinoids is going to reduce pain, if it doesn't, and especially not chronic pain, we have to think about what that messaging is going to do in the long term and what kind of problems that it might cause. As you know, most of our society shifts towards starting to use that to manage their pain. So I think it's really cool that you're doing research on this, and it's going to really have an impact on a society and the way that people actually handle their pain and they actually the relationship between pain and substance use disorders.
Yeah, that's huge. And shout out psychosocial behavioral treatments, because check it out, they don't have any side effects. And so I'm here to tell you, I think your work in this area is going to be really important as we begin to kind of take stock in this shifting landscape, if you will.
Mm-hmm. What you two both just brought up some really good points, and Sam, I appreciate you saying that, you know, my work is going to have an impact. I will also kind of dial that back a bit and say, you know, certainly I hope that it will have an impact, but it really is going to be this, you know, group effort where, you know, each study is incremental. And that's something actually that in graduate school I had to learn, because I was feeling like, gosh, you know, all this effort for each study and what is it, where does it get you? You know, it's just one small piece, because all of the questions I want to answer can't be put into just one study. I appreciate what you're saying, and also recognize certainly, you know, it's a group effort where we're all sort of chipping in. And then Noah, really good point about, you know, the behavioral treatments, and in terms of the side effects, that's actually something that I've thought a bit about before, actually now, because I'm in the PTSD clinic at my internship. And I know that, you know, behavioral treatments don't have any pharmacological side effects. And though certainly there could be other side effects, like when you are doing exposure therapy, for instance, you know, you might have an increased uptick in terms of anxiety or irritability or things like that. But I hear what you're saying. And certainly overall, it's less riskier, perhaps, than some of those other pharmacological type treatments.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's an interesting topic that I haven't thought much about. I need to chew on a little bit. But Des, thank you so much for coming. You know, also don't downplay your work and the impact that you're going to have. It's a group effort, sure. You know, that all of science is a group effort, but I want to acknowledge what you're doing and what you will do. And it's really exciting, and just to be a contemporary. I appreciate that. And we want to sort of transition into our take-home messages. And so what do you think the take-home message would be for people who are currently in recovery?
Yeah, good question. And I've been listening to y'all's podcast, and so I'm so excited that you are asking questions like this, because I think we can get caught up in the day-to-day and lose sight of why we're doing things. For folks in recovery, I think, you know, the first takeaway would be that you're not alone if you're experiencing pain and substance use together, that we know that this is a common occurrence and that people, you know, use these substances or use substances concurrent with their pain. So you're not alone. Also, that there are multiple types of treatments out there. So not just the traditional pharmacotherapy rather, that you can do, you know, other types of treatment as well. And then also that when you are experiencing pain, or if you're going to be, you know, doing a surgery or anything like that, just knowing that pain is associated with increased urge to drink, and that's specific to the work that I've done, that, you know, be aware of that and perhaps sort of give yourself an extra buffer during that time. You know, surround yourself by people that you can get emotional support from, or, you know, just pay extra attention to that so that you can really buffer yourself from those potential effects. The other thing I would say to people in recovery is really to try and seek evidence-based treatments for your pain and for your substance use, for that matter. That doing the research or asking providers to make sure you can get that care. And the reason for that is we know that that is what works based on the science. So I would really encourage you to you know, seek out those resources. I mean, the last piece, I guess, because I know I mentioned that last one might have been it, but I'm thinking too that it would be helpful for folks in recovery to know that using substances to cope with pain is not a long-term solution, right? That it might temporarily dampen the effects of pain, but that actually longer term, this has been shown for both opioids and for smoking, for cigarettes, that in the long term, it actually can make your pain worse. So just knowing that, I think, can be helpful for folks.
What would you say to practitioners out there listening?
Yeah, I think it would be helpful for practitioners to know that these things are associated, right? So for folks that are in the substance use services clinic, knowing that pain is a risk factor. I know, for instance, in the VA, we do assess for this at intake so that folks are already aware coming in, because it's a risk factor for lots of things. But knowing that, and then vice versa too, for folks in the pain clinic, knowing that substance use can sometimes co-occur, and that when both co-occur, it makes problems worse. So I think first and foremost would be, you know, knowing that they co-occur. Second, that pain could be a risk factor for substance use, and to increase the assessment of both of these things in the clinic would be helpful. I also think that, you know, we were talking about sort of the cross-cutting nature of both pain and substance use in terms of fields and treatment approaches, and certainly team meetings, you know, clinical team meetings are something that I can't, you know, understate that their importance. When you're getting different folks together and able to talk about their specific expertise, it can really make the patient care better. I know the VA does a lot of that work. That's what I'm most familiar with, but I'm sure it happens other places, and I would just encourage that it keeps happening, you know. And I think I said understate. I definitely meant overstate.
What would your take-home message be for policymakers?
Yeah, this is always tricky, and this is what I was kind of saying earlier with that. You know, research is, you know, one step at a time. So, you know, certainly all of this I say with a little bit of grain of salt, in that, you know, one study shouldn't inform necessarily practitioners or people in recovery or policymakers. But I think if we could get more support from policymakers to look at the research prior to making these policy changes, I think that would really benefit people and sort of properly or thoroughly, you know, advocating based on what the research says, I think would be helpful. And I'm specifically thinking of cannabis when I say that. But in addition, policymakers have a really great ability to give incentives for different things. So for instance, healthcare coverage. So if we can give incentives for things like assessing for pain and or substance use in different clinics, I think we would have a lot more knowledge at the forefront,
yeah,
and be able to, you know, potentially address some of those problems early on that maybe we wouldn't have otherwise. Another thought I have too is related to the incentives piece, but promoting different activities that we know can be helpful for people, both in recovery and who have pain. So for instance, like yoga is something that can be really helpful, both as a pain reliever if you do it right, and even as a distraction, for instance, or another activity for individuals with recovery. So if policymakers could start giving incentives for people to do that, whether it's, you know, insurance coverage or something of that nature, would be really helpful.
And what would you say the take-home message of this work is for underserved populations?
Mm-hmm. This is key. You all are amazing for asking this question in particular. I'm really excited to be a part of Division 50, knowing that this is a question that's asked of all interviewees. But I would say to those folks, not to give up on getting the treatment that you need. So we didn't talk much about this today, but unfortunately, underserved populations often tend to be misunderstood in terms of their treatment. So I say misunderstood at best, and at worst, you know, blatantly
ignored,
disparaged, and ignored. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for instance, when they present for pain treatment, some providers might just assume that they're drug seeking, especially if they have a substance use history. Right? But, you know, that's certainly not always the case. And I would even say never the case, because there's also often other factors that are at play. So find the providers and find the treatment that's going to work for you, and find providers who are going to listen to you, and try and advocate for yourself and or get other people to help you advocate. And then I mentioned earlier that there are different, you know, resources, so different types of treatment. Some of those resources and treatments are actually available on the web, for instance. So if you can't, for whatever reason, get the care that you need by going into a facility and getting that treatment, certainly try and seek out other online or web-based treatments if you have that capability, because they exist, and some of them are, you know, evidence-based and can really teach tools and tricks to help manage both pain and substance use.
Thank you so much, Des. That was all really informative, and you bring up some great points across all of those take-home messages. We've really enjoyed having you on. One final question for you. You've been really successful, and what kind of advice do you have for trainees who are, you know, coming up behind you?
Thanks. Success is definitely a moving target, for sure. I appreciate that you say that. It's sort of an obscure goal. But, you know, I would say that above all else, being able to create an academic creating an academic family early on in training is the most crucial and critical thing. For me, that certainly was the case. And maybe other folks who are less extroverted maybe would say something different, but I certainly feel that's the case. And many people I've talked to who are really successful in doing great things, it's in part because they have this whole family around them. So for instance, I have a wonderful, phenomenal cohort that I got really close with in graduate school. And then I also started attending Division 50 conferences right away in my first year. That's actually where I met up with Noah, and he sort of brought me under his wing in terms of Division 50, and, you know, met up with a lot of other really great people there too that I see every year, except during COVID, and mentors too. So when I say academic family, that's both peers and mentors. So really finding those supports all around. I'm a first generation college student. And so, you know, I didn't really have a lot of those academic mentors growing up. And so that's been extra important for me to just navigate the field and figure out what I'm supposed to be doing, when I'm supposed to be doing. And then not even just from a more like practical standpoint of getting information, but also it's fun. It's fun. I mentioned, yeah, you know, working with Martin, for instance, like it's a load of fun working with him on different papers, with Steve. It's phenomenal. And it makes the days, you know, go better, go easier, go faster. And it's a lot of fun. So, I think just, you know, very early on, as much as you can, start to cultivate that academic family, you know, to make it a place that you want to be a part of, because there are really hard times sometimes. And it's so helpful to have people that you can call, that you can cry to, that you can hug when something exciting happens, people who know, you know, what a publication is even. my family is so, so, so amazing. And they also have no idea what I'm talking about most of the time. So it's helpful when people can like speak the language. Absolutely. And I guess the last piece I would say is in terms of just sort of combating imposter syndrome, when you talk to other people and they say, oh yeah, you know, I was going through that too, or gosh, I think the same thing. And here they are, people that, you know, are amazing speakers. You know, I'm thinking, for instance, of Lauren Hoffman. I saw her speak, and I talked to her after one of her talks. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, you were phenomenal. How do you do that? And she tells me, I didn't talk to her about this to get her permission, but she said she'd been nervous actually, and that she doesn't feel, you know, super comfortable up there. And I was really stunned by that, but also was able to relate to that and, you know, kind of take that moving forward. So this academic family is amazing. So I hope that you find one like that too.
Yeah, that's a great point. We're all just humans trying to, you know, make it through life, make it through, you know, graduate school and our academic appointments. And it's better to do it together than alone. So thank you so much, Des. This was lovely.
Yeah. Thank you.
Next time on the Addiction Psychologist podcast, in our student episode, we'll have Laura Lesnowich join us. Laura is a doctoral candidate in clinical psychology at Rutgers and a pre-doctoral intern at Coatesville VA Medical Center. Her research focuses on biomarkers of alcohol use disorder.
And don't miss our upcoming episode in March with Dr. Lorraine Collins. Dr. Collins is the Associate Dean of Research at the University of Buffalo. She's a professor in the Department of Community Health and Health Behavior. And she will be talking to us about ecological momentary assessment and cannabis use.